My name's Michael Jarb. I'm the chair of the London Forum. I'm going to hand over in a moment to Michael Bark. There are too many Michaels in the London Forum. But just a couple of announcements to start with. First of all, we are, for the first time, recording this meeting. So the speakers will be on vision, but the only vision involved for members of the audience will be the backs of your heads. But if you speak to ask questions or make a comment, then that will be recorded. If you object to that, I suggest that you do not ask a question or make a comment. The other announcement I wanted to make is I know that a number of people in this room will know Leslie Hodgson of the Greenwich Society, who until very recently had served as a trustee of the London Forum. And she had to resign earlier this year, and she has now returned with her son to her native Australia with a brain tumour, which is desperately sad news. And I just wanted to, on behalf of all those who knew her and what she did with the London Forum, to be able to send all our best wishes to Leslie and her family. Thank you very much. That's all I want to say before I pass you on.
Well, we can mention this. This is our next event. You all have to start.
Have you got your...
Can you hear me all right? Good. Yes, you'll be looking to use AI for your society. It's very powerful in terms of researching things, digesting large reports. I mean, I'm not going to say what you're going to do, but do come to this because you're going to find it useful to help make us all more efficient and effective, bearing in mind also that AI is not entirely reliable.
It's not.
Okay.
The other thing to say is that it will be an interactive session, so you will get some practice in using AI.
Right, welcome to today. I should say that last autumn, when we had to decide what issues we were going to use... Sorry?
Can you stand near the microphone?
Nearer to the mic.
Well, I've got a mic here.
Is it higher up?
I did fire it up. I think I can hear the loudspeaker, but you can't.
We can't hear you.
I've got it on. I'll do it here. Okay. Last autumn, we decided that what are we going to have events? We must have events for our members. And we ummed and ahed, and in the end, we had about 10 issues. And I said to them, I said to everybody, name your top three. The top one was densification of the suburbs, which I thought was quite a controversial theme. But actually, with the help of Ben, our president, and Tony Travers, our patron, and planners from three different boroughs, they were able to present how densification could take place and that it didn't have to be the more threatening types that everybody seems to take exception to. This was our second choice, which is, of course, an easier thing to relate to, because everybody has Town Centre and High Street. And it's something that people do care about. The trouble is that there has been a lot going on in our town centres. So tonight's event is really something that you can have some resonance with. We've had a challenging decade or so with changing planning policies, growing online sales, COVID, vacant shops, rising costs, and our centres are in transition. But the real question is, are they going in the right direction? How can we maintain their vitality, and how do we make them more attractive and as a focus for our communities? Since 2005, the year when we had the first business improvement districts, there's been a rapid growth in the number of business improvement districts, town centre businesses joining together to increase the competitiveness of their centre, how we can then deliver better outcomes for our communities. So the first two sessions, one is on how things are going in town centres, the second is on business improvement districts. The third theme is London's nightlife. It's not just the pubs, the clubs, the music venues, which have been under huge pressure recently, and many of them have been closing down. The mayor's keen to support and grow London's vital nighttime industries. But how is that going to affect communities? So today we've got three sets of speakers. The first is about what has happened and where are we going with town centres. The second being what's been the growth and impact of business improvement districts. And finally, how do we protect, retain and grow London's nightlife? So I'm very pleased to see our second speaker has just arrived, Alex. I'm a bit worried. But our first speaker now is coming, is Steve Norris. Steve is in charge of planning regeneration infrastructure type projects at Lambert Smith Hampton. That may not be familiar, but he'll tell you what they do. And I've asked him to try and set the scene, how things have changed in the last decade or so, and looking forward, what direction we're going in. Steve.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, good evening, everybody. As Michael and Michael, thanks again for inviting me tonight. I've said I'm Steve Norris. I'm National Head of the Planning Regeneration Plus Infrastructure Business at Lambert Smith Hampton. I've got some slides that talk a bit more about Lambert Smith Hampton, but I've been told I can't do that, so I won't. All I'd say is Lambert Smith Hampton are a real estate, property, regeneration and residential advisor, so we're acting for the public and private sector across the country, not just in London. I also head up the Specialist Town Centre and Economic Regeneration team at Lambert Smith Hampton, and I've advised both the public and private sectors on town centre planning, regeneration and development for over 34 years, and I've known Michael a long time. I was also previously an expert advisor to the government's High Street Task Force, which was dissolved last year, and I sit on Revo's Regeneration Committee. Again, if you don't know Revo, they're the old British Council of Shopping Centres, a big public-private sector membership. A bit more about them later. And I sit on New London's Architecture's High Street Expert Panel. So in the next 20 minutes, I'm going to provide a brief overview of some of the critical issues and challenges facing our centre's high streets. I'm going to highlight some of the potential opportunities to help build back their resilience and growth. And I'm going to illustrate that with case studies from the UK, but obviously London focused, of course. I'll then address the critical question, and it is the critical question, who's best to lead and fund regeneration of our centres. And finally, I will provide my thinking on the future outlook for our high streets and centres. As I say, I'm going to skip through a few slides. I'm not going to talk about Lambert Smith Hampton, but there we are. That's the planning, regeneration and infrastructure business I set up, 150 advisors now covering those different areas from planning all the way through to land assembly. and we act at all stages of the planning, property and regeneration life cycle. The town centres team, and I've mentioned I head that up as well, and we're at the coalface advising local authorities, investors, developers, businesses and communities on the transformation of our high streets and centres. And for example, over the last 5 years, we've helped our clients unlock over £500 million of government-backed capital funds and grants to help deliver new regeneration and infrastructure projects in centres across the country. So some of you will be aware maybe of the Future High Street Fund, the Towns Deal Fund, the Levelling Up Fund, those kind of funds we helped our clients bid for, unlock monies. And they've had some criticism, but we actually have helped two big projects. One in Corby Town Centre was a derelict building, been vacant for about 11 years, and that we got funding, and it's now a sixth form college, 600 odd students in the heart of Corby Town Centre, kind of providing diversity in there. And in Tilbury, one of the most deprived centres and communities in the south, we got monies there. And one of the key things there was the youths had nothing to do. There was the perceptions of crime and safety were high. Kids were hanging around the streets. And this was all during lockdown that we carried out this engagement, very heavily involved with the community. And we're just about to deliver there a youth zone, the Thurrock Youth Zone, which will be all kinds of activities for 18 to 25-year-olds, including cooking and climbing and sports and everything else, as well as free hot meals and the like. And that youth zone is really going to change the dial in Tilbury and support the youth there. And that gives you some idea probably where we're operating in. And I'm going to talk about how the retail climate and how our town centres and high streets are changing and adapting to those transformations. So we understand the complex challenges facing the commercial property market in our town centres. Aligned with this, our advice is also formed by best-in-class thought leadership and research. I presume you'll get copies of these slides, so don't be doing it now, but there's a QR and a link that will take you into that our website and give you access to our research. I'm going to refer to two bits of research specifically for my presentation today. Shopping Centre Futures research that we produced a couple of years ago, and also... and that's why I mentioned Revo earlier, the research that we've been doing with Revo for the last, well, since 2019 now, on our town centres and high street. The one we published last year was called Shaping Tomorrow's Places. And one of the unique strengths of this research is it's an online survey of professionals, and it's not just Revo and its extensive membership, but it's also with other high-profile partners like the Association of Town and City Management, British Property Federation, UK Hospitality, ACIS, SIPFA, and the British Retail Consortium. I'm sure you've heard of a few of those. And last year, we had over 250 respondents to our online survey. All of those have an active role and vested interest in the planning, management, development, and funding of our centres. So it goes without saying, our towns, high streets, and shopping centres have all experienced seismic shifts in their role, structure, health, and performance over many decades. But before I set out some of the opportunities to deliver their sustainable transformation revival, it's important, I think, to first understand some of the challenges they are facing. And you'll be familiar with a lot of these from your experiences. The LSH Revo survey is a good starting point because we asked, and we consistently asked over since it started, what are the big issues our centres and high streets are going to be facing over the next 5 years? And consistently, business rate has been at the top of that in terms of responses. But also, you'll see on there as well, rising occupancy costs and the increase in national insurance contributions are all impacting on business viability. And I'll talk about how that feeds its way through. Online shopping, Michael's mentioned, we all know, 45% of respondents identified that. Online sales have increased from about 1% at the start of the millennium to 27% now, peaking at 38% during the pandemic. And there are different forecasts as to where we're going to end up in the next 10 to 15 years in terms of online sales. Other big challenges, again, you'll all be aware of, local authority debt, financial constraints, development viability barriers, and poor town centre environments. All of these are placing strains on our centres. And 37% identified as centres simply have too much retail floor space. And that's backed up by this question as well. With almost two-thirds of respondents, on average, year on year, this is since the start in 2019, identified between 20 to 39% of retail space in our centres is no longer fit for purpose. That's 20 to 39%. And over the last decade, this perfect storm of rising costs, growth of online retail, the pandemic and economic and global pressures have resulted in significantly more shops closing than opening. Some of the most recent casualties you can see on the screen there. And it's not just retail. Lloyds Banking Group is closing almost one-third of its branches by the end of 2027, principally due to the significant shift to online banking. I think there's about 21 million, I think the stat is, now use the Lloyds banking app. They're not just not going into the banks. And that has significant implications for our towns and centres, but especially smaller villages and local centres as well. National High Street vacancy levels currently stand at around 14%. But as we all know, and you all know, vacancy will vary from region to region, centre to centre, and by type of retail asset. Again, research that we carried out is particularly showing the difficulties the shopping centre sector is facing, where values have consistently lagged behind other property sectors like offices and industrial, and national average vacancies in shopping centres are higher than for high streets. So the average there is about 18 to 19% in shopping centres across the UK. And in our shopping centres futures report, we analyse the current role, status and composition of the UK's 500 biggest shopping centres. And we've identified that 12%, that's one in eight of the top 500, are not fit for purpose and need to be replaced. 40%, two out of five, need reinventing through major repurposing and part redevelopment. And 43% would benefit from revitalisation through smaller scale repositioning and repurposing. Significantly, only 5%, that's just 25 centres, require no significant interventions over the short to medium term. And this kind of confirms the scale of the structural challenges our towns and shopping centres are facing and the need, in some cases, for radical surgery and investment. So it's no surprise, again, with the survey, to hear that over two-thirds of respondents identify the redevelopment and repurposing of vacant retail space as the most important initiative to help build greater resilience in our centres and high streets over the next 5 years. This is followed by the need to improve town centre environments through placemaking, improvements to public transport and accessibility, delivering more new and affordable homes in our centres, reducing parking costs and or providing free parking, albeit the controversial, and preparing town centre visions, strategies and master plans, regeneration frameworks to help shape the future of our centres. As we look beyond retail, it's clear our centres and high streets need to adapt and diversify to help ensure their long-term survival. They need to provide more flexible space and a blended mix of uses that can respond to dynamic economic, consumer and market trends. And again, this was confirmed by the LSH Revo research, which identified healthcare, education, markets, food halls, civic, cultural and community uses as the new anchors for our centres, helping to generate increased trips, footfall and dwell times. And for the first time in last year's survey, the provision of new homes was the top use identified by two-thirds of respondents. The need for more creative solutions to replace our vacant and failing space is reflected by the responses to the closure of large high street anchor stores like Debenhams, BHS and House of Fraser. And this slide shows some examples of where former Debenhams stores have been or are currently being repurposed and redeveloped for new uses. And these include go-karting, bowling, indoor golf operated by Gravity Max in Wandsworth, Life Sciences in Oxford City Centre, new homes in Guildford and Portsmouth, and on Oxford Street, this former store is being transformed into a high-spec mixed-use development for new retail and Grade A workspace, along with a roof garden, pavilion restaurant and landscape terraces. Notwithstanding these good news stories, it's reported that more than 5 years since they closed, over half of the 169 former Debenhams stores are still vacant, along with up to one quarter of former BHS stores. Some of the vacant retail space is being taken up by new healthcare services and facilities. This reflects the NHS's drive to move medical services into the heart of communities, which was accelerated by the impact of the pandemic. For example, a number of CDCs have opened vacant shops and shopping centres, including the Mall in Wood Green, the Dolphin Centre down in Poole, and the Victoria Centre in Southend. And this is, for me, is a game-changing service with over 9 million additional screening tests, checks and scans being delivered by more than 165 operational sites since 2021. By X-ray and bone density scans. And the CDCs not only help to take some of the day-to-day pressure off already congested hospitals, their convenient and highly accessible locations mean they are also generating linked trips and spend to the benefit of other shops, services and facilities. And for landlords, they also offer secure tenants on long leases with a guaranteed income. And thankfully, Many of our more brutal urban landscapes are also being transformed by the introduction of high-quality public realm and green infrastructure. This is helping to deliver many tangible benefits for the environment, for habitats, for local economies, and for the health and well-being of communities. Some of the wider benefits are listed on the slide, and I won't go through these, I don't have time this evening. But interventions can range from big statements like introducing new town parks into centres to smaller interventions like simply planting more trees or introducing pop-up parks or parklets. And just like pop-up shops and stores, they provide a relatively low-cost opportunity to test business and consumer interest to see whether they can become a viable permanent fixture. In Harrow, for example, pop-up parks were installed along St Anne's Road post-COVID, close to the entrance of the St Anne's Shopping Centre, if you know that one. And this was part of the wider town centre greening programme led by the Harrow BID. And it's reported that the parklets not only boosted trade to local businesses, such as coffee shops and restaurants, by 30%, up to 30%, they also sparked a social media debate about air quality in the area. And across London, we're also seeing the redevelopment and repurposing of underperforming retail space and shopping centres for a mix of new homes, hospitality, leisure, community healthcare and cultural uses. High-quality public realm, street markets and event spaces are also transforming some of our centres from bland retail destinations into attractive and active community and social hubs. Now, I think, Michael, you don't want me to show this. This isn't London, by the way, you probably guessed. This is in Stockport, and this is the Castlegate Centre in Stockport that the council acquired through Towns Fund and Levelling Up monies. That shopping centre dominates the town, but had about 40% vacancies. The council bought it, decanted, they also bought the other shopping centre, decanted retailers that were left behind into the other shopping centre. And it's currently being demolished. There's a community diagnostic centre going in there as well. And it's creating this amazing riverside park that connects the Tees to the High Street. And that's the kind of visionary developments that we're now seeing. So moving away in that age where we built big shopping centres that destroyed high streets, turned their back on the shops and the communities like castles with big moats around them, car parks around them, we're now seeing this return to real street-led design with public realm and greening and rewilding right at the heart of it, event space and everything. And I wanted to just flag that up so in case you weren't aware of it, because it is amazing. And it's been applied elsewhere, nationally and internationally as well. But returning to London, and some of these are bigger schemes, but similarly, you'll know Elephant and Castle's been transformed, the shopping centre, into a new town centre. Over 30 new shops, restaurants and leisure units are expected to open their doors later this year, along with some 500 new homes and a new town square. And the next phases will deliver more new homes and student accommodation, a state-of-the-art campus for London College of Communication, and a 20,000 square foot cultural venue, all to be served by a new step-free entrance to the Northern Line Tube by 2028-2029. The regeneration of Wood Green Shopping Centre in North London, led by Haringey Council, will also transform the existing mall into a street-based town centre with over 6,000 new homes, a new town square, a mix of community, cultural and civic uses, and is forecast to create over 4,000 new jobs. And there are also plans to redevelop the former Marks and Spencer store on the High Road, which closed in 2015 for new residential, along with community and retail space. And again, another one that is well known is Brent Cross Cricklewood Regeneration, where Barnet Council and related Argent are delivering a new mixed-use town centre to the south of the existing shopping centre. And this will provide 6,700 new homes, 20,000 new jobs, new schools, communities and health facilities, and around 21 acres of new or improved public realm, all connected to the new Brent Cross West Station. But it's not just these and other sexy regeneration projects that are helping to breathe new life into our failing towns and shopping centres. Markets are also being revived and repositioned as key anchors and attractions, helping to animate and activate high streets, increase trips and footfall and reduce vacancies. Research shows markets can generate average footfall increases for town centres of around 25%. And up to 70% of market visitors spend money in other shops and facilities. And with low barriers to entry, markets are also excellent business incubators. The transformation, again, going outside London, the transformation of Altrincham's Victoria Market Hall is probably the most high profile and most quoted example. 15 years ago, Altrincham had one of the highest vacancy rates in the UK, over 25%, and was voted as having the worst high street in Britain. That's just 15 years ago. And it's since repositioned itself as a modern market town on the back of very strong vision and master plan. And this turnaround started with the council's vision, identified the almost derelict building as a catalytic project. And working in partnership with the developer, the market building was restored and now provides space for independent businesses trading side by side with traditional market stalls. And the success of Altrincham has become the template for the renaissance of markets and food halls across the country. And we're on the doorstep of obviously a famous market here, there are many examples in London of successful, diverse and thriving markets. In Bethnal Green, for example, Columbia Road's Sunday Flower Market attracts thousands of locals and tourists and was the winner of the best small outdoor market in 2025. Brixton Village has revived the failing Granville Arcade, which opened in 1937, and transformed Brixton from a local market into a premier London destination, fostering a vibrant and diverse food scene. The night markets in Hackney Central and Bexley Heath have also had a positive impact on their evening economies, attracting new visitors and increasing footfall and spend. And in the bottom right as you look at it, I wanted to just mention teenage markets. The first one was held in Stockport in 2012 with the aim of engaging young people in the area and giving them a platform to express their creative talents. And this initiative has encouraged the trial of new business ideas and creative new products and has since expanded to over 30 new locations. And it shows how markets are really evolving and changing. And in some cases, transformational changes can be achieved by simply harnessing community energy and pride in your local centres. And I guess you in the room here know that better than anyone. This slide shows some of the past winners and runners-up in the Great British High Street Awards. And I should have added into that Kingston Town Centre winner in 2014 for its new marketplace. And my home, where I live in Ealing, Pitsanger Lane, also won the title of London's Best High Street in 2015. And that was on the back of its community spirit, the high number of independent retailers there, and a successful social media campaign. That's my local centre, and you can see how that centre has thrived over the years. And to win these awards, the whole community comes together. So when the judges visit, there's a positive buzz about the centre, and everyone is on message. And perceptions, brands, and narratives around centres is important. And what you say about your place and how you build attachment and loyalty to it through marketing and social media can make a powerful difference. And I just wanted to then get on to the key thing, the key question I think about this is all great, but who's going to lead it, who's going to fund it, how are we going to deliver it? Easy. And it's probably one of the most important lessons I've learned over my 34 years of advising on town centre and regeneration is that nothing happens without these all coming together. But against the depressing backdrop of debt and rising costs and austerity, who is going to lead the recovery and renaissance of our centres? The simple answer, again, the LSH Revo has consistently said, it's the responsibility of everyone. Everybody needs to get involved. We all need to work together to deliver attractive, successful and sustainable centres. And the LSH Revo research confirms that the importance of partnership working and collaboration between all stakeholders, including national, regional, local government, occupiers, investors, town centre and bid managers, and most importantly, local communities. And in terms of how we're going to fund regeneration done into our centres and high streets over the next 5 years, respondents to the survey again consistently have identified joint ventures and public-private partnerships as the preferred investment and delivery vehicle for the sixth year running. Other funding options include private investors, obviously Homes England, the new and existing and new formed mayoral and combined authorities and the Public Works Loan Board. But surprisingly, given the financial constraints and debt many of them are facing, local authorities are still ranked second as an important funding source. And I say this is even more surprising when you consider that tap was turned off, the capital funds tap, the future high street was turned off by the new government. And that's reflected at the bottom there by the significant fall in these legacy funds to 12th in 2025, from when they were joint first the year before. The only capital fund that's been retained by the Labour, or the significant one that's been retained by the Labour government, is the long-term plan for towns, which has since been rebranded and repurposed as the Pride in Place programme. I think, Michael, you put some fingers up to me there. Was it two fingers, or how long have I got left?
Five
fingers. Oh, good. Okay.
At that time.
So the Pride in Place, under this capital programme, the government will invest up to £6 billion over 10 years in some 300 places across the country. And it's specifically aimed at the UK's most deprived communities and will help support struggling neighbourhoods and high streets over the next decade. Most of the deprived places originally identified were outside London, but based on the recent government announcements, in fact, in the last week, a number of London's more deprived neighbourhoods now look to set to benefit, including Barking and Dagenham, Brent, Croydon, Enfield, Haringey, Havering and Greenwich Thamesmead. And this programme represents a significant shift towards enabling communities to control their own development, to tackle dereliction and generate greater ownership and pride in places. In Hounslow, for example, funding from the Pride in Place programme will help deliver the Feltham Walk of Fame, a new mosaic trail through Feltham, celebrating local icons with connections to the area. It will also help fund shopfront improvements across several of the borough's high streets. And elsewhere in other centres, the programme will support projects ranging from planting trees and improving community spaces to installing CCTV. To conclude, I want to offer up some of my thoughts about the future prospects for our centres and high streets. And it's clear to me they are still, and they still have a vital role to play in the country's economic recovery and sustainable growth at the local, regional and national level. The pandemic has also shown us that they are valued by communities and businesses for more than just their shops and services. There are undoubtedly more economic, market and political headwinds on the horizon, and there's no one-size-fits-all approach to revitalising and regenerating our centres. But our research and case study examples have identified there are a mix of actions and interventions that, taken together, can help deliver healthy and viable centres. First and foremost, our towns and high streets cannot stand still. They need to evolve and diversify if they are to survive and flourish. And although retail and leisure will still provide the bedrock for many centres, helping to generate trips and footfall and spend, the most successful future centres will be those that can reinvent themselves and breathe new life back into vacant and underused assets and places and spaces. This includes providing a blend of new types of leisure, workspace, civic, cultural, education, healthcare, community and other uses. Flexibility will be absolutely key. Aligned with this and helping to address the housing and climate crisis, we need to build more new and affordable homes in our centres that meet the needs of all socioeconomic and age groups. But bridging viability and funding issues will be a significant challenge, and that's another presentation. But in response, we do need these more patient long-term funding vehicles. This responds to one of the lessons from the previous government's capital funds programme, which is that you can't just turn off the tap on investment after 3 to 5 years. Hence why Pride in Place is a step in the right direction, albeit the monies aren't, there are 20 million's a lot of money over 10 years, but it's still not going to be enough. And that's where I believe Homes England, if you're aware of Homes England, they should have a critical role to play, providing resources and long-term patient funds to help address viability issues and kickstart and deliver critical regeneration projects and new homes. For example, they've stepped up in Nottingham and acquired the Broadmarsh Centre there to help the council deliver the redevelopment of that critical project. And I've got about a minute. Delivery will also depend on establishing strong leadership and governance structures and on greater collaboration and partnership working, not just between the public and private sectors, but across all stakeholders and local communities. Everyone needs to be part of the planning and decision-making process rather than a footnote or an afterthought, again, which is the positive thing about Pride in Place. Creating successful centres will also need to be underpinned by robust and deliverable visions and master plans that balance high-quality placemaking with delivering critical commercial, environmental and social value objectives. And placemaking, creating beautiful centres, places and spaces with a good mix of buildings and blue-green infrastructure, should be the ultimate objective for everyone involved in the planning, development and management of our centres. Final slide. We asked our respondents in the last LSH Revo survey what a successful centre in 2050 should look and feel like. And they identified it should be connected, safe, affordable, livable, green, healthy, entertaining, diverse and resilient. For me, successful future centres will be those that help to promote health and well-being, tackle deprivation and the climate crisis, and provide viable, attractive and entertaining places where people of all ages want to live, work, shop, study, play and socialise. And above all, they should be vibrant, fun and safe places, restored once again as the beating hearts and souls of our communities. Thank you.
Well, we certainly set Steve a very large task, and he tried to cover an awful lot of territory. But thinking of your town centre, and I don't mean the small neighbourhood centre, but to the main high street, how does this relate to what you're trying to achieve in your high street? I wonder if anybody would like to... Yes, would you like to say who you are?
Michael Levitsky, I'm a member of the London Forum.
There's a microphone behind you.
Oh, there's a... Okay, thank you. Michael Levitsky, I'm a member of the London Forum exec and of the Finchley Society. I am very involved as a campaigner in my local town centre, which is North Finchley. Some of you may know it, most wouldn't. It's quite a large one, it's primary, I think. And we face it, the biggest problem we face is that despite all the nice words, the pride in place, everything else, the only thing councillors, the council and the GLA cares about is housing. And high streets are brownfield sites, essentially. They can be demolished, they can be redeveloped. Developers are completely uninterested in using the wisdom that we've heard here to create a viable town centre in North Finchley. So it's basically they want to turn the town centre into a residential area with a few shops and restaurants on the ground floor. No offices, no proper community areas, tiny town squares overshadowed by 7-Eleven, 15-storey, 21-storey and 16-storey buildings. What do we do about the obsession with housing that is preventing us going forward with these very sensible regeneration proposals? Okay. Thank you.
We have very limited time for any discussion, so it's better that you can make a pointed question, maybe.
I did have a question. What do we do about the government's obsession with housing? I ended on a question.
Okay. Well, I could answer that. What we need is both. In other words, you need to keep the commercial uses rather than them disappear, and you need housing above. And the other thing is to remember that offices generate actually more activity in the shops than people living above them. Peter.
Peter Everson, Vice President of London Forum. I'd just like to ask Steve about the hundreds of small businesses in railway arches. They're being driven out by Transport for London and National Rail, trebling their rental costs. I just wondered what's going to happen to them and how can they still continue as part of their local facilities and services that people need.
Steve, would you like to come up?
It's quite a specific question. Railway arches. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, you go to a place like Dalston and Ridley Market there that are based around the kind of railway arches, and you've got the stalls there and a very successful market that creates a lot of activity. I think it's quite difficult, unless, and again, it goes back to the other question as well. A, let's make sure they've got good advisors on board in terms of the what they're trying to do there. So obviously, I always say that one. But also, you need a really strong plan that sits behind it as well. You know, and I talked about visions and master plans. It's so important. And unfortunately, in this age of budgetary constraints, local authorities are just processing applications rather than thinking more strategically and planning forward. But if you've got a master plan for your area that's been involved all of your key stakeholders, the community and businesses, and it's a robust plan, it's a deliverable plan, it's a commercially viable plan, but it's had that input, then you've got something that you can use to frame future development. And if preserving businesses in railway arches is a key feature of that, that should be baked into any plan. And I think that's really important. Unfortunately, we're losing that. The government are committed. I mean, the previous government was the same, 1.5 million homes by the end of this parliament. You know, station gateways now, they're moving the levers so you can get development within that station gateway area. They're doing everything they can to build, and unfortunately it's at the expense of affordable housing, because affordable housing policy means that most housing schemes in London and out of London as well are just not viable. So they're squeezing down the affordable housing provision, so you end up with this mono-tenure again, which will create problems going forward. But the only thing they want to do is build more homes. They've got a target that they said they're going to do, and they're going to do it. or they're going to try and do it. Homes England are the same. They're there to deliver new homes. So some of those big sexy schemes I talked about, we were talking about 7,000, 10,000, 20,000 new homes.
Yes, the arches are a real problem because TfL is acting just the same as any private landlord and are using the increased income to put it into their transport budget. They try and generate money from property, advertising, and any other source they can. So they're actually trying to just maximise what they get from the sites. But in the process, it's getting rid of a lot of cheaper accommodation for certain types of businesses.
There are creative things. I like Waterloo, you know, the underneath the station there, the arches. And if you go into Bristol, the Temple Meads there, you come out of there, they've used the arches for kind of event space as well. So there are creative ways of making them work, but the pressures are there. The TfL now and Network Rail are together. Their Platform 4 and their business plan will be launched in April, so we'll find out more about that.
We've got there's a mic coming.
One thing you didn't mention is the role of tourism.
Yes.
And so I'd be interested to hear your comments on that. I have another question as well, which has a question related to it. It seems to me, I come from Highgate. We have a very historic high street. The shops are very small. It's very unique, you know. And it seems to me, well, it's also divided between two boroughs. Mm. And it seems to me that every shopping centre is, and it's a very small shopping centre, every shopping centre is different. Mm. And I know you've tried to put things into categories like that, but how do we address that unique, historic shopping situation, small shops, difficult access for disabled people, a busy high street with traffic, not a lot of natural green space.
Short sense. get a good advisor.
Yeah, right.
No, but tourism, I mean, tourism in London. I mean, London is. I mean, you talk about the crisis in London's town centres. But, you know, yes, there are areas and there are centres that are struggling and need a bit of TLC. But, you know, I operate in really difficult towns across the country from the north all the way down. And, you know, they're struggling with viability, with funding and the like. They don't have some of the unique assets and attractions and just the kind of DNA of a lot of London centres, you know, that's built into them. And you've got a lot of great things there. It's just making it more viable. So if there are issues there, how do you address those? Yeah, but you've got that. The Highgate's got, you know, it's amazing. So it's just kind of.
Thank you very
pleasure.
Much. Now we come to our second speaker, and he's going to tell you about business improvement districts. Can I just have a quick check? How many of you have got a business improvement area in your area? That's not too bad. You're thinking of Kensington High Street, and so am I, because until recently, I was one of two residents that were on the board, but many of them don't have residents on. I know that Eric, where are you, Eric? Yes, Eric is an angel, was it? Yep. But it's quite unusual. In America, where this was invented, the boundaries were shrink-wrapped around the businesses, and the last thing you wanted is residents involved. Whereas, in fact, our town centres, everything's mixed in. So business improvement started in America. I'm not going to take too many of your lines. But the interesting thing is that although it's been going since the 60s and 70s in America, and there are over 1,000 bids, there are 76 in New York. And the interesting thing about that figure is that although we started late, we now have 76 precisely in London. Anyway, central London has got a number of very large bids. In fact, a large part of the area is covered. And these are usually the common factor is that the businesses have come together to work to get an improvement to the area over and above what the local authority could do themselves. It shouldn't duplicate anything that the council is doing. And this is enabling the businesses to mobilise enough resources to promote the place, get further improvements, negotiate for better deal for improvements with the local authority. So our next speaker, Alex Jan, chairs the Central District Alliance and Hatton Garden Bids, which includes this area, Farringdon, Clerkenwell, Holborn, Bloomsbury, within the bid area. And he's been involved in this issue for quite a long time. I've given him a difficult job because I've said, can you relate your experience that you've had to what would it would be like outside the central activity zone, where you haven't got quite the same amount of revenue that can be generated from the levy? He will tell you all about it. Sorry, I should have said, Alex, in addition to this, was previously chief economist for the Arabs, and he advises the property sector in central London with regard to the prospects of growth. Does that sound right?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you, Michael, and good evening, everybody. On a Thursday evening, the week before Easter, to be hearing me drone on about business improvement districts. I thought we were going to avoid housing, but, you know, glad I didn't have to take those questions. But no such luck. Okay, first deliberate mistake is, of course, I got the date wrong because I was preparing these late last night, so apologies for that. As Michael says, my involvement in bids over the last 6 or 7 years is in this area, around the corner up in Clerkenwell, and then Bloomsbury, very close to where I live, which is always a useful thing to be a resident living in central London when you're talking to residents who we do talk to in Holborn and Bloomsbury and elsewhere. I'm also, just for complete transparency, on the board of the Merrill Development Corporation for Old Oak Common and Park Royal, which has just recently seen a new bid come into its area, North Acton bid, with the blessing of the local authority there. And as Michael said, I spent too much of my life writing reports, Arup and various other places. But we've actually known each other, must be getting on for 35 years, yeah, from our right times at
early 90s.
Early 90s when we were both at, help me out here,
LARTA.
Say again?
London Amenity Transport Association.
Yeah, and the green, the transfer, the breakdown agents. Anyway.
Yes.
PPG6, I think. Is that you? Is that all? That was all you, wasn't it? So I always remember Michael because of PPG6, amongst other things. He's already helped me out with the slides, but what I was going to touch on is just a little bit about where they came from. Why have them? And you might well be asking that question, but I think I've got some good arguments in favour. You might have others not less in favour. A little bit on where they are in Greater London and, as per my instructions, outside the central activity zone. So you'll be pleased to know I'm not going to drone on about central London. I will talk a bit about it, but I've learnt a lot in putting this presentation together for you this evening. Something about bid impact and value, some of the challenges, and then just a few sort of closing thoughts. So as Michael says, I mean, technically the first bid was actually in Canada, so we'll have to call it North America. And was sort of in this nice little place called Bloor West Village, the Bloor West Village Business Improvement Association, which was set up in 1970 in not far from Toronto, so it's in Ontario, nice part of the world, under Section 217 of the Municipal Act. And it was really brought together, it was created in response to a new subway station, which meant that commuters, instead of going on the street railway, they went into town, they commuted on a subway, so they weren't passing through. So it's a small shopping-type area. And also the malls, you know, motorisation, big malls. So they lost a lot of footfall and trade as a result of those two particular developments. And with about 275 merchants, they raised 47,000, I assume, Canadian dollars, in 1970. It's quite a lot of money by today's standards. And they spent it on things to prettify the shops, put make it a bit more welcoming. And as I say, first bid probably in the world, and remarkably, they're still there today, which you may regard as a failure or you may regard as a success. Now, bids actually came to London, or the UK primarily, more specifically, in about 22 years ago. So Simon Parker of The Guardian wrote an article, I think it was Simon Parker who wrote an article at The Guardian, based on the report of somebody called Jerome Weimar, who actually worked with me in a previous life at KPMG. I'll leave now. And Jerome wrote this report for his master's degree on bids, and The Guardian picked it up, and then they got some more work done. I think Tony Travers of the LSE was involved, and that's where it kind of caught the imagination of the Blair administration, and legislation was introduced in 2004 under Part 4 of the Local Government Act. And in essence, you know, in terms of what are they, I mean, I know you will know this, but they are a defined area, as Michael said, in which local businesses vote to invest together to improve their environment. And when they do that, everybody gets a vote. The vote is based on a combination of two things, where you need to get a 50% plus one majority. One is the number of hereditaments, so how many individual business rate bills that determines what a each hereditament has its own business rate bill, if you will. So each property is such enclosed, proper, discrete property. And then also on rateable value. So rateable value has to be over half, and the number of individual votes based on the number of hereditaments also has to be over half. And if the vote goes through on that basis, then everybody who was eligible to pay under the scheme as proposed to the ballot, everybody has to pay. So it is, in effect, a form of taxation, if you will, because for that factor, it's not a voluntary payment. You can be a voluntary member of a bid, and we do see some companies and institutions who join areas that might just be outside the area and so forth, so you can be a voluntary member. And there are normally very deep discounts for charities and the public sector, for museums and galleries and so on. In the areas I work in, that discount is 80% typically for some of those institutions. There are now about 340-odd bids in the UK as a whole, and about one in five, as Michael said, are in London. Now, unlike in the US, or New York to be more specific, they are mainly occupier-led. They're nearly all occupier-led in the UK. So what does that mean? It means that if you are in a building and you're paying if the business rates bill is addressed to you as the occupier rather than as the owner, you're the person who has to pay the bill. In New York example, it's mainly it's owners who pay the bills. The other big difference with the US model is that bids here have to go through a renewal process every 5 years as a ballot with a proposal, which is put to the ballot. In New York, the bids are in perpetuity. So once they're set up, they're there forever, but they serve at the pleasure of the New York City government. And if they and they're actually quite heavily controlled and regulated by city government in New York, whereas ours, their main relationship is the boroughs, and they have oversight, but they have less oversight than in the case of New York, and I think that's partly reflects that governance model. The property owner bids that do exist for a technical reason, at the moment can only be in London. They're not allowed outside of London, and they can only be where you've already got an occupier bid. They can't extend beyond that, but there is some talk of that legislation changing. And if you really want to know over a glass of wine, I'll tell you why. So why have them? Well, it's a good question, and it's a good question for two reasons. Because if you look at the original reason for bids being set up in places like North America, as we've already identified, a key driver was, you know, to do things that no one else was doing. So, you know, as I say, so coordinated activity to improve street frontage, to put on events, you know, to drive footfall, to do Christmas lights, that sort of thing. Things that local authority maybe didn't do so much of. In the UK experience, the principle of additionality is one that we kind of hold dear to our hearts as BIDs. But the reality is that if you look at the evolution of local government expenditure, which we've already heard a little bit about, the BIDs in many cases are up against the fact that local authorities are seeing the level of real spending power they have fall over time. So, for example, in real terms, spend per person has fallen by about 28% in real terms in 2024 compared to 2010. And as you will all know, local government expenditure, two-thirds or more in many cases, is spent on adult social care, on special educational needs, on social service provision, and people with sort of very expensive to meet needs, which we can all agree needs to be met. But what that does mean is that if you're a business, let's say in Holborn, paying £1 million in business rates, then out of that £1 million, first of all, about 90% plus of it goes to central government, which is a point I want to come back to. And out of that remaining £100,000, let's say, maybe £20,000 or £30,000 is going to be spent on things that you and your staff actually see and experience, because the rest of it is being spent in other parts of the borough. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it is a problem if you're trying to improve things like streets and trees and the environment and so forth. And the other related point to that I do want to make is the extraordinary extent to which local government funding is centralised. So it started really with Mrs. Thatcher when she nationalised business rates, and it's a policy that has basically been perpetuated by successive governments of all political persuasions, including the current government. I mean, in 1900, about three quarters of local government funding came from local taxation. So if you were Liverpool, where I'm from, three quarters of your income came from property taxes and charges that you were levying on your residents and on your businesses. Today, I'd be amazed if it's, well, the case of Westminster, Westminster effectively retains about 1.5% of the business rates it collects. Westminster collects about 1.8 billion in business rates, and it gets 139 million from the government in government support and business rates sort of back. So the combination of government using local authorities to collect business rates and then reallocating those on a needs basis is highly problematic if you're trying to grow your tax base or incentivize growth in the tax base and then spend that money on things that residents and others want. It's a big disconnect, and I think it's highly problematic. But now I'm only on slide two, so I'm going to have to really speed up. The other thing I'd say is BIDs can move more quickly. We can just do stuff more quickly, right, because of the processes that we have in place. Local authority rightly has to go through a whole set of, you know, if you want to put hoardings on something, there's a 9-month consultation process and so forth. They also have convening power. You know, we had a meeting today with Camden about street works, we had the museum and other businesses in the room, so we can talk and try and lobby. And we are grassroots, so the people who sit, you know, on the Hatton Garden bid board are a range of jewellers and major institutions and consultancies, so they're very much in the area and of the area. And they bring expert local knowledge, you know. I'm sure pride in place is a marvellous thing, but the reality is that the people who know Hatton Garden best, the people who live and work there, not the civil servants who are determining who gets what through the High Streets Fund or these other things, which I've seen firsthand at ARUP and sort of wanted to hold my head in my hands, really. We are a voice for business. We advocate for things. We can commission studies. We can, whatever you think of it, the Aldwych scheme at the bottom of Kingsway. Without the BID, that would never have happened, even though Westminster in the end paid for it. And we bring, we have legitimacy because of the ballot process. I'm aware that there are concerns about transparency and governance, but fundamentally, compared to Thames Water, for example, they don't have to go through a ballot process. You know, the BIDs do. And crucially, we are partners for local authorities. And over the last 20-odd years, they've collectively raised about £1 billion. These are the BIDs in London. And there's some great resources on londongov.co.uk. and these are them sort of listed out. And interestingly, about half are in the CAS and about half are outside by my maths. Don't count them all because the numbers won't add up, but I think it's about 37 outside of the CAS and sort of 39, including the property owner bids, in the centre. And they're generating around £60 million of income a year, which is then being spent very locally. So outside of the central activity zone, I mean, in some ways, you know, I looked at various websites and various other things, but actually they're not, they're kind of same but different from the central London bids in this, perhaps a little bit understandably more parochial. So they are, you know, as many of you will know, they are about trying to do things to particularly around retail. Many of them are retail orientated, trying to drive footfall and create a sort of safe and welcoming environment for people at a very local level. They're trying to create a sense of place. They're trying to mitigate the effects of traffic or problems with antisocial behaviour. They're trying to put these places on the map, facilitate street markets, those sorts of things. And then in some cases, they're on industrial estates. And on industrial estates, they might be helping with parking. They might operate parking schemes. They might provide extra security, CCTV, better lightings, and so forth. So interesting that industrial estates tend to go after them as well. And they typically tend to have smaller income. So the central London bids, as you can see here, this is quite old data now, but on the far left, we've got New West End Company in the West End with income of around sort of 4 to 5 million, and the central London bids are in that sort of order of magnitude. But many of the CAS bids, the outer CAS bids, maybe 50, 100, 150, 200,000 a year. So they're more modest in scale, which reflects their footprint and the level of contribution from their members. So I talked a little bit about what they do, these are some of the things that I've picked up. You know, sometimes they can be very effective at helping to secure grants, secure new money, as well as simply spend the money that they raise on various things. Some of them provide things like affordable workspace. They take over public toilets. They do collective purchasing for commercial waste, for power, those sorts of things, stationery and so forth. And they act as a champion often for high streets and with a focus on that retail market. And many of them also provide intelligence and analysis for their members to tell them what's happening to footfall and spend, those sorts of trends. So in terms of impact and value, this is where I'm allowed very briefly to talk about us. This is Prince's Circus. Some of you may know it, just off Shaftesbury Avenue. And the picture on the left, which isn't as bad as it should be really, is the sort of what it looked like before. And the picture on the right is post completion as part of Camden's broader, much bigger West End project. And we put £1.5 million into this particular project, and that money would have been used to enhance the quality of materials, the planting, the lighting, and so forth. So those are the sorts of things that, you know, this space will be used by tens of thousands of people a year, going to the Shaftesbury Theatre and walking through, and so forth. So it's a good example of, I think, of good bid impact and value. And then this is Hatton Garden, which, as you know, is the jewellery district. Christmas is a busy time for them. So we try and do things like light the place up, make it more attractive on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, we do what many local authorities don't do anymore, which is jet wash the street. So we're interested in kind of, you know, a higher level of intervention to deal with grot and filth. And then policing, big issues in Hatton Garden, the truth be known, with a degree of serious crime. So we are charming the Met into being there more often. We've been very supportive of them, and we are about to start a program of paying for overtime for police officers because the businesses are telling us they want people in uniforms present, hanging around to put off bad people from doing bad things. Challenges. Well, here are three of my favourites, really, or 2.5 of my favourites. Commercial waste is out of control in terms of the way it's regulated and managed. Road closures, utilities, Thames, hope there's no one here from Thames, you know, digging up the road, taking 10 days to do 2 days' work. And then the general sort of problem of corrosion. You know, it's a corrosive atmosphere, parts of central London, so drunk people will snap trees and all the rest of it. And similarly, another one of my favourites is phone boxes, which are used as bins and for smoking drugs and toilets and all the rest of it. And so we try and focus on some of these things on a day-to-day basis, but also actually in terms of writing excellent reports from Create Streets to try and get these problems knocked on the head. So in terms of some of the actual challenges, the more intellectual challenges, one of them is awareness and recognition. A lot of people don't know that the BID exists. It's a complicated creature. It's alien to the British way of governing. So you have to spend a lot of time trying to raise awareness, understanding and recognition of what we are, what we do and what we don't do. And on the resident point, boroughs represent their residents. BIDs deliberately, in many cases, choose not to go into residential areas in their boundaries because they're not raising money from the residents and they don't want to be seen to effectively be overlapping with what local authorities are doing. We do, however, try to maintain good relationships with them, I'd say. And on 95% of things, I would argue that residents and workers and business owners want the same thing. And clearly there are examples of where it hasn't worked out. There is this sort of slightly intellectual argument, if you will, about the extent to which if you improve an area, that then leads to people leaving and the problem of gentrification. All I would say is, if you look at some of the images I showed you and some of the challenges we have, those are the things we're dealing with. If only you could gentrify it. This is unfortunately, in a part because of the way local government's now funded, we're really on the front line in trying to make these areas better. And I would argue whether it's, Sloane Square or Grimsby, people kind of want the same things: safe, welcoming, green, clean, nice shops and so forth. But that does mean that we have intruded into the area of public service provision. I mean, the reality is we have these service level agreements with local authorities, but every time the tide goes out a bit further, we do on a 5-year basis have to say, well, how much of that gap are we going to fill? And that is an issue. And I guess it's also quite hard for us to demonstrate economic impact. We cover big areas, we're only one player, so how much can we actually point at and say, because of us, this or that happened? Nearly last slide, Michael. Michael's talked about the resident business BID interaction. We do get people complaining that we're jet washing the streets. Sometimes they shouldn't be jet washed that early in the morning, but we think residents probably want jet washed streets, perhaps not at 3 o'clock in the morning, rather than having them sort of, filthy and grotty. And then the final point is this additionality point. How do we maintain that what we're doing, to demonstrate that what we're doing is over and above what the public sector would otherwise be doing? So I think the evidence shows BIDs are firmly part of the London Town Centre policy landscape. They renew. We've been going now 25, we're just into our fifth term, so they renew years, they've been renewing now for many years. They're definitely an anomaly in the British system. They're very unusual because of this hypothecation, something the Treasury hates. And remarkably, our expenditure hasn't been equalised away by the government from Camden or the borough's expenditure. I wonder if that's next. I think that London in particular is going to see more loss of income for local authorities, Islington, Camden, Westminster, the City of London, and K&C. So that means we're probably going to be expected to do more. And I genuinely do think that if they're well run, they can create lasting social, economic and environmental value. I mean, the reality is that, we help put young people into jobs fairs, entry-level jobs. We have a big ESG program, mayoral academies, that sort of thing. Dress for Success, helping women to get into work, that sort of stuff. And we do, many, many BIDs do those things. But aiming off for all of that, absolutely BIDs need to ensure they act as responsible members of civic society, and we do have to work in partnership with local authorities and the communities around us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was extremely informative. There may be some questions. Yes. Would you like a...
Two quick ones. Could you explain hypothecation? And secondly, it seems to me there's an...
Could you hold your microphone?
Sorry. There's an inherent clash between what residents may want and
and what businesses want. And these are business improvement districts. And Kensington, where I am, they told us we want to increase footfall. Well, the last thing we want on Kensington High Street is increased footfall, and we can hardly get along the street as it is. With something useful, public toilets, hasn't been done. So it seems to me there's a clash between residents' needs and business needs.
Okay, so hypothecation is it's just basically you raise money from...
You spend the money on the things that were in the area or on the function that from which you've taken the money. So you know, if you raise money from car parking, you spend it on car parks. I'm suggesting, by the way, we should do that, but that's all it means. It's a sort of allocation from the source at which it came, if you will, which the Treasury really doesn't like. My experience is that actually there's far more in common between what residents want and what business want. I take your point, you know, in the case of Kensington, but by and large, you know, when I walk the dog in the park in Russell Square and I explain a bit of what I do, people are fascinated that it's, because they say, oh, it's your people who come and clean our street after someone's vomited in it the night before. It's not the council, it's because they see these people coming around in these green overalls and they have no idea who they are. So I agree that not everything that business wants to do chimes with what every resident wants, but by and large, the sorts of things that we're trying to do, which is to look after areas and make them safer and more welcoming, my experience is that residents, by and large, want that. I mean, clearly, some residents don't like economic activity at scale, and I understand that. But in parts, you know, in central London, where many of us live, I think that kind of comes with the territory to a certain extent. Now, whether we can have more of it or we want less of it is a good question. But in terms of these businesses surviving and thriving and then being able to invest in the area, you kind of, you know, I mean, if you take Sloane Street, which the Cadogan Estate is on, I mean, they've just spent £40 million on Sloane Street of their own money. And I guess they kind of want the footfall to drive the value to then allow them to invest in those sorts of schemes. But I agree, it's a choice and it's a balancing act.
There's one at the back over there. If you want to talk to me later about Kensington High Street.
Good evening, Clive Whittaker, Hampstead Neighbourhood Forum. You mentioned that in the UK, you contrasted it with the American model, and you said that the funding of bids was sometimes seen as a bit of a tax. We have had that problem in Hampstead where the bid failed at renewal and now doesn't exist. And I think there was a sense amongst local businesses that it had been, you know, imposed on them and it was a tax. I wonder whether you could elaborate perhaps a little bit about the funding model of bids in the States. And we do in this country have, in the 19th century, a strong kind of subscription model for local philanthropy, which perhaps exists a little bit less than it used to be. It's much more top-down now. Just wonder whether you can perhaps elaborate on how do those businesses survive financially in America, and how does the financial model differ?
Okay, so I'm aware of Hampstead, and I read various things last night about what people had to say about Hampstead bid. I have a slight problem in so far that there is a ballot every 5 years in which people have the opportunity to vote yes or no. I mean, one of the comments was the bid has, in the case of Hampstead, which is very controversial in the end, but one of the observations was the smaller businesses have been disenfranchised because they've been taken out of the bid threshold. So in other words, they've been excluded from the ballot because they would no longer have to pay if they were in the bid, if you saw what I mean. So they're no longer being asked to pay, therefore they don't have a vote. And that was kind of interpreted as a form of discrimination, which I kind of slightly, I just think that's an interesting way of looking at it. In the case of New York, it's mandatory in the New York system as well, in the sense that once the bid is there, the owners of the buildings have to pay the bid levy. The difference is they don't have a ballot every 5 years. And as I mentioned before, certainly in the case of New York City, they are much more heavily sort of regulated and overseen by New York City. So, and they tend to be big players. They tend to be, you know, big property owners in Lower Manhattan and Times Square and Midtown and all the rest of it. So it's a more stable model in some ways. It's not without its controversy. I think they tend to raise more. And they kind of spend them on similar things to us. But my sense is they probably spend a bit less on the basics where we're trying to help out our local authorities. And they spend more on promotion and events and putting things on. But the big difference is, as I say, they don't have to renew. You could argue that's less democratic. I actually think that having a five-year renewal is very good. Keeps us... We have to start, you know, we have to justify our existence and think about what we're trying to spend people's money on. I just kind of wish we could get more engagement, you know, at the same time.
I think we're going to have to move on to the next